the country, multiplying the risk exponentially. In only 5 years, the bank's assets grew from $62 million to $520 million. It was the great annexation of lending. It was hard to tell where true wealth stopped and wild speculation began. The bank's reckless generosity allowed total bumblers to become lavish players in the energy game. Gary England, then in his 30s, was just successful enough as a weatherman to afford a new house out in the suburbs. When he went to Penn Square Bank to get a loan for the down payment, the loan officer looked at him like he was crazy. Only $4,000? Why not $10,000? Why not enough to pay off the whole house? Why not an even bigger house? Why not? By 1980, OKC seemed to have reached its ultimate goal, an everlasting bonanza. Everyone was suddenly investing in everyone else's investments. Everyone ran their very own company, and sometimes two or three. Wayne Coyne's father started a business that distributed office furniture, which kept teenage Wayne and his long-haired brothers busy hauling desks and chairs and cubicle partitions into and out of the headquarters of these booming businesses all over town. Capitalism had blessed Oklahoma City, and the city wanted to express its thanks. At the height of the boom, local businessmen pooled their money to create a brand new attraction that, even by the very special standards of Oklahoma City, was spectacularly strange. It was an interactive museum, a kind of secular shrine to free enterprise, designed to help local children appreciate the sanctity of capitalism. It was called Enterprise Square, USA. Fundraising was led by E.K. Gaylord's son, E.L., who managed to scrape together $15 million. The museum would become, for generations of Oklahoma school children, a staple on the field trip circuit. Kids rode up a glass elevator, in which they were showered with encouraging messages, spend, save, buy. Then they walked through the Hall of Giants, among effigies of the great heroes of capitalism, Alexander Graham Bell, Henry Ford, Sam Walton. They cowered beneath the talking face of government, a creepy giant head covered with flashing TV screens, which taught the children about the dangers of taxation and regulation. Next to the world's largest cash register, four enormous paper bills hung on the wall, and their giant founding father heads sang a barbershop quartet about freedom, the animatronic faces jerking around like figures in a Chuck E. Cheese band. Futuristic touchscreen games allowed kids to compete for profits as ranchers or bankers or oil magnates. Many of the exhibits were sponsored by local corporations, dairies, energy companies, and nakedly designed to promote their products. At the gift shop, you could buy bumper stickers that said, "I love capitalism." When Enterprise Square, USA opened in November 1982, Ronald Reagan himself sent a statement to be read aloud. On its editorial page, the Oklahoman published a touching cartoon in which a man labeled John Q. USA realizes with a smile that American free enterprise is a good thing. The celebration, however, was not quite the full-throated triumph its organizers might have expected. The Capitalism Museum launched 4 months too late. Although it was built at the height of the boom, Enterprise Square USA opened in the depths of a bust. In July 1982, Penn Square Bank's towering house of cards finally collapsed. When oil prices started to decline, the strain on all those precarious loans was more than the bank could stand. Customers came to withdraw their money, and soon they were waiting outside by the hundreds. The money, insofar as it had ever existed, was gone. The failure of OKC's drive-through bank set off bank failures across the United States, starting in Seattle. And finally, the federal government had to step in with a multi-billion dollar bailout to keep the blight from destroying the national economy. All over Oklahoma City, companies crashed and folded. CEOs had their Cadillacs seized and auctioned off. Gary England knew an oil executive who was suddenly mowing lawns. During the boom, it had been easy to imagine Oklahoma City's blasted downtown, rallying and rebuilding. The bust destroyed that hope. It was no longer possible to see the ruined core as a landscape in transition. It was, simply, what it was, a self-inflicted wasteland, a nothing where there used to be something. By now, it was clear that the city's grandest plans had failed. Instead of creating a universal city, the great annexation had left a placeless sprawl. Instead of invigorating a declining downtown, the pay plan had killed it off. Russell Klaus told me that it was as if Oklahoma City felt so bad about what the United States did to Germany in World War II that it decided to do it to itself. It was a dead decade. In 1984, the National Finals Rodeo, a sort of Super Bowl for cowboys that Oklahoma City had hosted for 20 lucrative years, left for Las Vegas. The luxurious Skirvin Hotel, where Pei first presented his Pei model, had managed to survive urban renewal, but it could not survive the 1980s. It kept changing owners, then went into foreclosure, and finally, it was abandoned. Pigeons moved in. In all of downtown, there was only one functional hotel. "Downtown is dead," said a city council member in 1988, "and we helped kill it. There is no major retail, no major attraction, and no place to eat." At Enterprise Square, USA, the touchscreens and talking robots soon became obsolete, and over the years they broke down, and capitalism provided no money for repairs. The museum grew shabby and sad. The field trips continued, although at this point the children were probably learning different lessons than the ones the founders had intended. All over OKC's deteriorating roads, cars sported a new bumper sticker. "Please God, just one more boom. I promise not to piss it away this time." On I.M. Pei's final trip to Oklahoma, in addition to his advice about finishing the job of urban renewal, he had also offered a few words of wisdom about demographics. "Bring the young people back," he had said. "Young people are like salt and pepper. They cause trouble, yes, but they also bring excitement. Young people, however, are not spices that sit around waiting on racks. They are not folding chairs. They are sentient and unruly, and they tend to be drawn to specific stimuli, change, danger, glory, and above all, other young people." All of those things were now absent from Oklahoma City. Wayne Coyne, of course, stayed. He lived in the city center, and he worked at Long John Silver's, frying fish bits on what had become a sketchy stretch of Klassen Boulevard. He was such a faithful worker for so many years that the restaurant tried multiple times to promote him. But Wayne refused, choosing to remain a third mate. The neighborhood grew increasingly bleak, and one day, the Long John Silver's was robbed. Wayne and his co-workers were forced, at gunpoint, to lie face down on the dirty kitchen floor. Everyone was sure they were going to die. But the robbers eventually left, and everyone was okay, and Wayne and his co-workers leaped around together, next to the deep fryers, hugging and crying and laughing about the glorious miracle of life. As Wayne put it to an interviewer years later, "The things I used to worry about just didn't matter to me anymore, that I would look like a fool, that I would do something and people would think I'm an idiot. I just didn't give a shit anymore. I was like, I'm going to do my thing, and if people think I'm an idiot, fuck them. And that's freedom." He founded the Flaming Lips shortly thereafter. In 1989, Oklahoma City celebrated its 100th birthday. This was supposed to have been the grand payoff. Back when the pay plan had been proposed, in the optimistic days of 1964, city leaders imagined that the centenary would be an orgiastic celebration of OKC's greatness. The city, they fantasized, would host the World's Fair. The new downtown malls would be overflowing with shoppers, the huge new roads surging with cars. The pay model, by then, was supposed to have come to life in the real world. Instead, Oklahoma City, in 1989, looked only like a ruined version of Oklahoma City. The crowning glory of urban renewal, Pei's Grand Galleria Mall, was never built. Those six dense urban blocks had been destroyed for absolutely no reason. The area became a vast parking lot. I. M. Pei, in 1989, was off in Paris, presiding over the opening of his celebrated renovation of the Louvre. In Oklahoma City, the roof of the convention center leaked so badly that dinner guests had to hold umbrellas. Even if OKC had managed to win a bid for the World's Fair, it wouldn't have been able to afford to host it. Instead, in 1989, OKC hosted the Olympic Festival, an off-year pseudo-Olympics hosted by minor American cities such as Colorado Springs and Syracuse and Baton Rouge. The festival was directed by Clay Bennett, then only 29 years old. Its motto was, "Winning a Place in the World." In a touch of civic poetry, the mayor in 1989 was Ron Norick, the son of Jim Norick, the mayor who had presided over the Great Annexation and urban renewal. Norick the younger would have to find a way to rescue the city from the failed grand plans of his father's regime. In 1989, he tried, but failed, to land a new American Airlines maintenance center for OKC. The company chose the sexier destination of Fort Worth. The following year, Norick went after United Airlines, which was planning to build a repair facility that promised $1 billion in construction, 8,000 jobs, and $700 million in annual revenue. For that kind of economic stability, OKC would have traded in two generations of its young people. Nearly 100 American cities lined up to compete, but few of them could muster the raw, desperate hunger of Oklahoma City. Legislators called emergency sessions to concoct outrageous corporate incentives. OKC's citizens even agreed to tax themselves to raise $120 million more, a measure that passed, amazingly, with 72% of the vote. One by one, civic competitors fell away. Cincinnati, Dulles, Fort Worth, until OKC found itself in United's final 10. Then it was in the final four, and then, after Denver yielded, in the final three. Louisville folded. After nearly a year of wooing, United's decision came down to Oklahoma City and Indianapolis. Outside United's headquarters in Chicago, in full daily view of all the decision makers, a new billboard went up. "Come fly the friendly skies of Oklahoma City." United chose Indianapolis. The company's CEO told Norick that OKC's proposal had been, by a large margin, the best prepared, well-organized, the most professional, the most courteous, the most responsive. OKC, essentially, had won. But it had lost, and because of one problem. United could not imagine making its employees live there. Indianapolis had NBA basketball, NFL football, public transportation, a downtown canal, and renovated old buildings with shops and restaurants and hotels. Oklahoma City had a dry riverbed and a blasted, vacant downtown and empty restaurants that served chicken fried steak. This rejection was a new civic low point. Revenue was zero. The infrastructure was wrecked. The population was unnaturally dispersed, and the young people had quite sensibly left. Oil companies were beginning to sneak off to Houston. Everything the city tried only seemed to make everything worse. Oklahoma City's grandiose self-image bore less resemblance to reality than it ever had. The place was, as Mayor Norick put it, a blank. "You could shoot a cannon down the street," he said, "and it wasn't going to hurt anybody." The Chamber of Commerce polled OKC's citizens and found that 65% did not think it was a good place to live. The chamber responded, naturally, with a PR campaign disseminated on the radio and in print called "It's a Wonderful Life in Oklahoma City." But it wasn't, not in most of the important ways. No more booms were on the way. The city had no more dice left to throw. Game 70. Westbrook, 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 Westbrook. On the basketball court, all through the spring of 2013, the process held. After KD's cursing and Westbrook's storming, The squabbles quieted. Tempers cooled. Winds mounted. Heading toward the end of the season, there was exactly the lack of drama you would want in a serious title run. The team looked like heavy contenders, more dangerous even than they had been the year before. They were 50-19, the best record in the West, and they were outscoring opponents by an average of more than 9 points a game, a margin that put them right up there with some of the best teams in basketball history, Bill Russell's Celtics, Magic Johnson's Lakers. A rematch with Miami in the finals seemed like a virtual certainty, and this time the Thunder would go into it better than the year before. They were efficient, long, fast, mean, professional, and wildly athletic, with two legitimate superstars. Looking this good, after sacrificing a talent as magnificent as James Harden, was already a front office victory. But of course what counted at this point was success in the playoffs. In the last few weeks of the regular season, Kevin Durant found himself in a virtual statistical tie with the Knicks' Carmelo Anthony for the league lead in scoring. A little push, a few extra shots here and there, would bring him his fourth scoring title in a row. Instead, Durant let it go. He shot infrequently and sat during blowouts, watching his average decrease. It was as if he were doing Anthony a favor, or perhaps proving a point. Over the final 10 games of the season, as Anthony hoisted 20 or 30 shots a game, Durant held himself to a modest 10 or 15. He was done, it seemed, with individual accolades. All he wanted was a championship. The Thunder were so dominant toward the end of the year that even Daniel Orton started to get real playing time. Over 1 2-week span, he played in 5 games, including nearly half of a game against Sacramento, during which he looked like an all-star. He flew around the rim, tipping in multiple Russell Westbrook misses, and threw down one dunk so hard that the ball came popping back up off the floor like a champagne cork. Even the visiting announcing crew was impressed. His career, perhaps, was beginning to find its feet. On March 22nd, the 70th game of the season, the Thunder went to Orlando. For Orton, it was a kind of homecoming. This was his first NBA team. He still had a house in the city. These were the fans who had clamored to see him play when he'd first entered the league, when he'd been a first-round pick full of promise. The game turned out to be a fairly comfortable Oklahoma City win, but Orton didn't play. Afterward, a crowd of fans stood waiting near the Thunder's bus to get a glimpse of the players. When Orton walked out, a cheer went up, screams of recognition. People started to chant, "Westbrook, Westbrook, Westbrook, Westbrook." Orton kept walking and got on the bus. The East. As I explored Oklahoma City, I got into the habit of asking the people I met, architects, journalists, historians, policemen, athletes, planners, to show me around their OKC. It's such a big and disconnected place. Eventually, I figured I'd be able to overlay all these different maps to start to understand how the many worlds inside of the city related to one another. Early on, I drove around the city with a rapper and activist named J.B. Williams. He was polite, but also bluntly honest, acknowledging the city's failures while declaring, almost in spite of himself, his love for it. He had moved constantly as a kid, so he knew the whole city, and to drive with him was to see an entirely different OKC from the one I'd been shown on my official city-sanctioned tours. It was like seeing the place under an ultraviolet light. He pointed out neighborhoods that were excluded from all the tourist maps, places I'd passed by hundreds of times without even thinking to look. We drove through the North Highlands, right next to the super-rich enclave of Nichols Hills, and although it looked to me like any other suburb, JB said it was one of the poorest places in the city, gang territory. And as we drove, he kept pointing out red cars, which he said meant allegiance to the Bloods. We passed apartment complexes that had recently been fixed up and given fancy names like Heritage Point, but JB said not to be fooled. Those places were bad. So bad that you wouldn't go in unless you had family there. Every thriving section of OKC seemed to have some secret pocket of misfortune attached to it, one or two blocks off, places that were immune to booms and somehow extra vulnerable to busts. We drove through Deep Deuce and an area called Parker Estates. We drove past farms, woods, empty lots, abandoned strip malls, and vast stretches that looked like untouched prairie. JB knew it all. "What's this neighborhood called?" I asked at one point, in what seemed like the middle of nowhere. "I don't think this really has a name," JB said. "We would probably just call it the East Side." But the East Side seemed to be everywhere. "There's a lot of East," I said. "Exactly," he said. The city's white neighborhoods had, in recent years, been lovingly divided into distinct micro-hoods. You couldn't go three blocks without encountering a sign: Automobile Alley, Midtown, Heritage Hills, Mesta Park, the Plaza District, the Paseo. And yet large portions of the East Side, which dwarfed all of these neighborhoods geographically, remained untrendy and unlabeled. Even to those who knew it best, much of it was simply the East Side. Mayor Jim Norick's Urban Renewal Board was, naturally, entirely white. When challenged on this point, he was defensive. "There are people on this board who can represent the Negroes on the East Side as well as anyone," he insisted. Unfortunately, the evidence did not bear this out. James Baldwin once said that urban renewal meant Negro removal, and this was certainly true in Oklahoma City. On the East Side, the city's urban renewal vision revolved around a huge new medical complex that would require bulldozing large swaths of houses. Some influential leaders of the black community, however, agreed to support it. Their thinking was that urban renewal was an anti-poverty program, and the East could use some anti-poverty. City planners promised that dilapidated buildings would be knocked down, but that homes worth saving would be fixed, and that the area's terrible infrastructure would finally be improved. Local civil rights leader Jimmy Stewart, a disciple of Roscoe Dungy's, agreed to participate as an advisor. Things did not work out as he had hoped. In true OKC style, the plan quickly grew out of control. In 1965, the city's leaders visited Texas, where they saw that Houston's new medical center was practically a city unto itself. They came home inspired. In Oklahoma City's original plan, the medical complex took up 50 acres. Now it would occupy more than 200. This would mean, of course, the destruction of more of the black community, not just dilapidated tenements, but solid middle-class homes. Stewart eventually pulled his support and started fighting urban renewal, but by then it was too late. Neighborhoods were cleared. The medical center was built. New freeways, with their gigantic cloverleaf ramps, were stamped on top of more bulldozed black homes. The fractions of neighborhoods that survived were suddenly islands, cut off from the rest of the city, not only by the freeways and the medical center, but eventually by large new government buildings with parking lots the size of city blocks. What would once have been a pleasant walk down to Deep Deuce was now basically impossible. Toward the end of my drive with JB, he steered me over toward the medical center. Medical centers, actually, plural. Because over the decades, they just kept coming, stamping out more and more houses in the East. The poor neighborhoods got smaller and poorer. JB drove me to one of the tiny remaining pockets, where his aunt still lived, in a house that had been in the family for generations. Traffic roared nearby on the freeway. Next door, an abandoned house had recently burned down. Not far from there, we passed the governor's mansion, and then the Oklahoma History Center, a shining glass temple to the preservation of the past. JB waved his hand at it. "All this used to be houses," he said. "I had homies living in these houses. All this was houses. All this was houses." "Where did they go?" I asked. "They went further east," he said. Game 83. 5-1. The NBA playoffs started on a Sunday, April 21st, 2013. This was what all of Oklahoma City had been waiting for. The regular season was fine. It was a blessing. It had its moments, but this was where the glory was. All year, the time had been streaming by like wind, streaming toward this, and now the great low-pressure swirl of eternity was beginning to gather itself up, thickening, condensing into a single moment that everyone could inhabit and savor and remember forever. It was all beginning to happen. The previous year's loss in the finals, the self-doubt after the Harden trade, OKC's many decades as a national non-entity, a site of only tragedy or disappointment, a non-place. All of this could change now. A non-place did not win an NBA championship. That morning, like most of the rest of Oklahoma City, I went to church. I did so at the urging of Wayne Coyne. This was a crucial aspect of the culture, Wayne said, something most residents built their lives around, and I would never fully understand the place if I neglected it. And of course, that was true. Angelo Scott had helped found First Presbyterian. Clara Looper had gathered her sit-in demonstrators at Calvary Baptist. Stanley Draper had been a superintendent at St. Luke's. He'd always left precisely on time, and if his family wasn't in the car, he drove off without them. There were many hundreds of churches to choose from, but Wayne recommended, as a perfect distillation of the current culture of OKC, a new one called LifeChurch.tv. This was a rapidly expanding franchise. Its reputation was young, hip, modern, suburban, and light. Church for young professional families, convenient to the freeway, without all the boring ceremony or historical baggage of the older churches downtown. If you couldn't make it to your local branch of LifeChurch.tv in person, you were invited to watch on the internet, following along in your e-Bible, with no shame or judgment attached. And so, very early in the morning, I found myself merging onto the freeway to drive up the Centennial Expressway north along the border of the east side, next to the route of the original railroad tracks, all the way out to suburban Edmond, to the flagship campus of LifeChurch.tv. I slid into the enormous parking lot and entered the capacious lobby. I passed the children's play area, which was bright and extravagant and fully staffed, like a displaced pocket of Disney World. An usher handed me a pamphlet. I entered the sanctuary, which was vast and dramatic in the style of a TV game show set, complete with dramatic miniature spotlights pointing every which way, and exposed steel beams all over the ceiling, and live music from a rippingly professional Christian rock band. If a Starbucks drink could be a church, it would be LifeChurch.tv. I settled into a pew. The pastor strolled the stage in jeans, and after some introductory remarks, he directed our attention to a large screen, on which another man in jeans, with rolled-up sleeves and the hint of a goatee, spoke enthusiastically about the Lord. "Oh, snap," he said. "Check this out. Jesus had a problem." He referenced Twitter and Facebook and the YouVersion Bible app. The day's pamphlet had a series of fill-in-the-blank questions, and the speaker prompted us frequently with the answers. "Let's bring this down to street level," he said. "Jesus was really serious about this deal." When the e-sermon was done, the screen went dark. Our local MC stepped back on stage. It happened to be the Sunday after a terrorist attack at the Boston Marathon, an incident that, for historical reasons, had special resonance in OKC. Our LifeChurch.tv minister offered the congregation guidance. "Here's what we do," he said. "We shine brightly. That's what we do. We let the light of Jesus, through us, shine as brightly as it can, because there is no darkness, there is no terror, there is no hatred or evil that could even come close to competing with the light of Jesus Christ. The light of God eradicates it and illuminates it all day long." As the offering plates came around, the minister told us that anything we could spare would help the church spread the gospel via the internet, primarily in Muslim countries. "Do you realize that?" he said. "You are lighting the world when you give." Before sending us back out onto OKC's freeways, the LifeChurch.tv MC mentioned one last thing. The NBA playoffs were beginning that night, he said, and this prompted a theological question. "Did God prefer one team over the others?" The crowd laughed knowingly. As a man of God, the minister said, all he could do was consult Scripture. He opened his Bible and read us Psalm 29. "The voice of the Lord is over the waters," he said, "and the God of glory," he paused to look out meaningfully at the crowd, "thunders." The sanctuary exploded. The playoffs could begin, now with God's blessing. The Thunder's first-round opponent did, in fact, seem divinely chosen. It was the Houston Rockets, which meant that OKC's title run would have to begin with the destruction of James Harden, the first impurity in the Thunder fairy tale, the cause of so much trouble and wounded love and civic self-doubt. During Game 1, I sat next to Royce Young, proprietor of the Daily Thunder blog, who drew my attention before tip-off to the team's official programs. The cover of the Rockets featured Harden, by himself, screaming ecstatically while popping his jersey in triumph. The cover of the Thunders featured a photo of the entire team, all 12 of them, from Kevin Durant to Daniel Orton, looking serious and professional and determined. It was the perfect statement of the two different organizational philosophies, and at least part of the reason Harden had wanted out of OKC. The Thunder, with two of the brightest superstars in the game, refused to promote any individual over the group. Their portrait was defiantly, boringly corporate. Orton was, at least on paper, as important as his miniature doppelganger Westbrook. It was pure Sam Presti. Game 1 was a sustained on-court demonstration of these competing philosophies. While the Rockets relied almost exclusively on Harden, the Thunder were cohesive and overpowering. It was an almost instant blowout. The Thunder dunked and swatted away layups. The Rockets missed their first 9 shots. And OKC led at halftime by 13, and in the fourth quarter by 35. Harden was swarmed and harassed, reduced to nearly impossible shots, step-back jumpers, and twisting layups, and the crowd cheered each of his many misses as if they were apologies. The game was one long civic party. The fans whipped towels around while full-throatedly singing the title song from Oklahoma. Whenever a Thunder player missed a free throw, the crowd gave him a huge ovation to encourage him for the next one. It was a whole new level of ecstasy, beyond anything I'd seen in the regular season. During a break in play, when a fan made a half-court shot to earn $20,000, the cheering was so loud it felt like a solid block of noise on the floor. At one point, I shouted at Royce, who was sitting 2 feet away, about how loud it was. He shouted back that this was nothing. During previous playoff runs, he said, we wouldn't have been able to hear one another, even if we'd been screaming directly into each other's ears. So OKC was holding something back. It had been to the first round plenty of times before, had begun to expect the glory. In the fourth quarter, after the blowout was secure, Scott Brooks pulled all the starters, and OKC fans started to leave the arena with 6 minutes left to play. That, it seemed, was that. Westbrook and Durant appeared at the post-game media table together. Durant wore a leather jacket over a paisley button-up shirt. "There's nobody like this guy," he said of his point guard, who wore large translucent glasses along with a thick gold chain over a sleeveless black sweatshirt. Later, Harden slouched over the same table, his beard tucked against his chest, murmuring sadly. He complained that every possession felt like he'd been going 1-on-5, an analysis that was essentially correct. But then, that's what he'd signed up for when he'd left Oklahoma City, and it was clearly not going to be enough to win, at least not this year, not against this team. Game 1 felt, somehow, like a single-game series sweep. Game 2 was coming, and a couple of more games after that, but Thunder fans were already allowing themselves to begin to think ahead, not just to the second game, but to the second round, and then the third, and then the finals, and then the championship parade on Reno Avenue, and then further championship parades in the years to follow. James Harden was now no longer part of the story of the destiny of OKC, and that seemed just fine. It was his loss. 2 superstars would be more than enough. We who have long been dust salute you. At midnight, While the city was still basking in the afterglow of Game 1, the calendar clicked over to an extremely important date in Oklahoma City. April 22nd, Land Run Day, the anniversary of the chaotic beginning of it all. OKC loves to celebrate the insanity of its origin, so April 22nd has always been a low-grade secular holiday. In the city's early years, there were downtown parades featuring the 1889ers themselves, who would ride in wearing the same gear they'd rode in with on that first afternoon. As the decades passed and the pioneers died off, young Oklahomans learned to carry on that tradition. Land Run Day became part of the elementary school curriculum. Every April 22nd, a new generation of OKC kids was taught to recreate the historic event in miniature out on the playground. They dress up in cowboy hats and bonnets, unite into temporary families, form strategic alliances, load up little red wagons with supplies, and then, at noon, they'd race off to stake claims next to the monkey bars, or the curly slide, or the baseball diamond, or the tetherball poles. JB, the rapper, told me that his mother refused to let him participate. She said the land run was not for black people, and anyway, the land had been stolen from the native tribes, so her son would not be play-acting any kind of tribute. His teacher let him sit out while the other kids ran. April 22nd, 2013, was an even more special Land Run Day than usual. The people of Oklahoma City had been waiting for it, in fact, for exactly 100 years. The day had arrived, finally, to open the Century Chest, the time capsule buried by Angelo Scott and the other leading citizens of 1913. Around 9 a.m., people started to file into the wooden pews of the First Lutheran Church. The governor and the mayor came, as did bankers and oil barons, Chamber of Commerce members, city council representatives, all the people you would have seen at the playoff game the night before. So many ordinary citizens showed up that the crowd overflowed the church itself and spilled into an auxiliary tent out back, where a screen had been set up to show the ceremony via live stream. This added an appropriately 1889 vibe. Under a cloudless April sky, a throng of citizens crowded into a tent. History seemed ready to burst out into the present. And history did. A crew of workers, solemn as pallbearers, carried the century chest into the church. It even looked like a crude coffin, a battered metal box, big enough to hold a man. The mood in the room was subdued exhilaration, a crowd trying hard not to be as excited as we all actually were. Time capsules are notoriously disappointing. They're supposed to be magic existential wormholes to a lost reality, but instead they are almost always empty, damaged, full of junk, further depressing evidence, as if we needed any, of the absolute tyranny of time. Oklahoma, in fact, had recently experienced one of the most notorious time capsule disappointments in history. In 2007, the citizens of Tulsa had gathered to see a 1957 Plymouth sports car, fresh from the factory, brought up out of a concrete bunker that had allegedly been strong enough to withstand a nuclear bomb. After 50 years underground, however, the car looked less like a Cherry antique than like an ancient shipwreck, a car-shaped film of rust, and everything inside it had dissolved, and one of the organizers actually cried. The century chest had been entombed beneath 5 feet of concrete since the year before the breakout of World War I. It sat, now, in front of us in the church. We silenced our cell phones and fidgeted in our pews. Politicians made prefatory remarks. Finally, the chest was opened. There was a moment of suspense before the historians, with their white gloves, began to remove the items one by one. As soon as they did, it became clear that the century chest was not going to be disappointing at all. The Ladies' Aid Society had sealed the box perfectly. We were about to experience something that felt like time travel. The world of 1913, right there in the room with us, in all of its fresh urgency. The historians held up item after item for the crowd. A little boy's dress suit from one of the old downtown shops, still folded neatly and looking brand new. A wooden Choctaw bow. A 1913 phone book, plus a clunky old-timey phone to make calls with. A judge's gavel. A glass container of wheat. Newspapers from the day the century chest was sealed, hot off the presses, tucked into the chest moments before the lid went on. A black pair of ladies' shoes, retail price $5, still gleaming with a visible shine. It was an overwhelming abundance. The documents were all marvelously dry, and the colors were so bright that, more than once, the crowd in the church gasped. This was the platonic ideal of a time capsule. No mold, no rust, no death, no decay. There were photographs of Geronimo, of David Payne, and of OKC in all of its early phases, 1 hour before the land run, 9 days later, 6 weeks later. There was a Kodak camera full of undeveloped film. There were hotel restaurant menus and high school yearbooks and reference works about the science of chiropractic. There was a Choctaw hymnal and an Osage translation of the Lord's Prayer. There were personal letters addressed to my children's children, to the modern woodmen of America, to the art museum, to the worshipful master, wardens and brethren of Oklahoma City Lodge No. 36, AF and AM, and its Masonic posterity of the year 2013. The blind citizens of 1913 had included a letter in Braille to the blind citizens of 2013. It was an effort of the past to reach out and touch the present. The historians took out wax cylinders, which contained, almost unbelievably, audio recordings of the early citizens singing and speaking. The chest even contained a machine to play the cylinders on. One cylinder held the voice of Angelo Scott himself. He had recorded it on this very spot, inside the First Lutheran Church, exactly 100 years before, at the original century chest ceremony. Scott read, aloud, the letter he had written to us, the people of the future. He was an orator, trained in the grand old 19th century style, and on the wax cylinder, his voice sounds echoey, a little stilted, but what he said gave me chills. "We are consciously making ancestors of ourselves today," Angelo Scott told us. "We, who have long been dust, salute you." 100 years was suddenly nothing. Our now began to blend with the now of the Oklahoma City that was gone. Time circulated freely. We inhaled and exhaled it. We twisted with its twisting. We felt the fullness of these absent people's lives, and, by extension, the fullness of our own future absence. It was disorienting, uncanny, thrilling, scary. The Century Chest organizers had commissioned the leading citizens of 1913 to write predictions about life in 2013. A physician predicted that we would all have evolved to be physically short, weak, and nearsighted, with giant heads, but also that we would by now have eradicated cancer and houseflies. An Episcopal bishop predicted that all the world's religious sects would have merged into Christianity. The newspaper of 100 years hence, the editor of the Oklahoman wrote, ought to be, and will be, I believe, a veritable paragon of accuracy, terseness, and comprehensiveness. A lawyer predicted the liberation of women. Where now women amuse themselves with bridge whist and pink teas at their social functions, he wrote, then they will pass the time discussing affairs of state and the betterment of their fellow beings. Anton Klassen, the father of the streetcar system, prognosticated that transportation in 2013 would run on compressed air. The president of the American National Bank seemed to predict email. The 1913 manager of the Huckins Hotel wrote a letter to the hotel's current manager, summarizing the building's history and financial prospects, as well as sharing strangely personal details. The writer is about 5 feet 11 and a half inches tall and weighs 231 pounds with reddish hair and is slightly bald. It ended on a note of optimism, wishing you success and trusting the property is still a handsome moneymaker. The Huckins Hotel had been demolished in 1971, however, as part of urban renewal. The inventory of the century chest was admirably precise. It accounted for every single object but one. There was, somehow, an inexplicable glass marble. It was loose, unwrapped, unlabeled, rolling freely around in the chest. The historians were flummoxed. Their best guess was that a child might have popped it in there at the last second, while none of the adults were looking, perhaps while they were praying. And that, of course, was the perfect OKC touch. One speck of uncertainty, a single atom of chaos, had been rattling around for 100 years in the midst of all the order. All your bad days will end. Sitting in my century chest pew, in that tangle of Oklahoma City time, I started to feel existentially confused. Everything in OKC seemed to be coming together. Its founding and its future. Its basketball and its civics. The place seemed, against all the odds, right on the verge of realizing its founders' most grandiose visions. The spirit of the land run was alive, galloping around, firing its pistols into the air. And, to my surprise, it was alive in me, too. For many months, I had been reading about Oklahomans, talking with Oklahomans, dancing with Oklahomans, gossiping with Oklahomans, interviewing living Oklahomans about dead Oklahomans, thinking about what made Oklahomans Oklahoman, trying to distill their Oklahoma-ness. The vanished people and their vanished places had begun to seem alive again. I had come to believe in Oklahoma City as a radical experiment in something, an expression of American democracy or American foolishness, and I felt a stake in its well-being. I wanted its public tax programs to remain wise and generous, wanted its boulevard to be well-designed, wanted the black and white communities to know and respect and love one another. I wanted its remaining interesting buildings to be saved. I wanted honesty and openness to prevail over secrecy. I wanted its actual history to be acknowledged, regardless of how ugly. I wanted Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook to coexist. Wanted the loss of Harden to be survivable. Wanted Presti's process to be vindicated and celebrated. Wanted the city to abandon its booms and busts and embrace something more sustainable. I wanted Daniel Orton to play himself into the rotation and get meaningful minutes during the playoffs, to somehow find himself on the court in Game 7 of the Finals, where he would block LeBron James's game-winning dunk attempt as time expired and become the hero who brought a championship to his hometown. I wanted Wayne Coyne's love to come into full equilibrium with the external world. I wanted tragedies to stop busting out of the Oklahoma sky for no good reason on otherwise clear spring days. Irrationally, at this point, I felt almost Oklahoman myself. I felt that I existed in all the different versions of Oklahoma City at once. I felt like I wanted to make the land run. A little before noon, I got up from my church pew and left the century chest ceremony. I walked out to my rental car and drove away from downtown. It was so easy to leave, so fast and smooth, and I merged onto the Centennial Expressway, heading north, and then onto Stanley Draper's Highway 62, heading east. And soon the city of Oklahoma City receded behind me until all that was left was the Devon Tower on the horizon, and soon even that was gone. And the city turned into the country, and I felt like I was driving backward in time, rewinding the founding. The prairie began to reassert itself, the wide sky to spread out wider. I drove out into the vast non-human expanse, past the borders even of the great annexation. The towns that had tried to take purchase here over the years had never amounted to much. This was land that still belonged stubbornly to the land. I drove as near as I could to the eastern border of the unassigned lands, what the settlers of 1889 called the Pot Line, because the territory on the other side belonged to the Potawatomi Indians. It was the closest point of entry to the spot that would become Oklahoma City. And, best of all for the settlers, it was unsupervised. On April 22nd, the morning itself, something like 1,000 people gathered there, at a ranch house right near the border, which belonged to William McClure, who would become, thanks to his relay of fresh horses set along the trail, the first legal settler of Oklahoma City. In the absence of soldiers, the potline settlers had to signal the start of the land run themselves. At noon, or something like it, a man tied three handkerchiefs to a pole and swung it down. Everyone charged off into the future. I arrived from that future exactly 124 years too late. Today, the potline is nothing. It runs unmarked through a small country town called Choctaw, which sits just outside the reach of modern Oklahoma City's massive gravitational pull. I drove down Choctaw's abbreviated Main Street and parked behind a Baptist church. I tried to imagine what the scene would have looked like 124 years earlier. There would have been no church, of course, no asphalt, a ranch, the primordial trees uncut, prairie grass up to my knees. I would have stood jockeying for starting position in the middle of 1,000 competitors, men on horses, on wagons, on foot. Oklahoma or bust, some of the settlers would have scrawled on their wagons, ignoring the fact that those options were not mutually exclusive. We would have smelled terrible waiting there, like many lifetimes of non-showers, and we would have exuded the unsettling buzz of mass desperation, that very Oklahoman, very American feeling that everything was right about to change forever, for the better. Most of us would have been wrong. On this day, in 2013, the potline was quiet. At noon, I fired a mental starting gun and began to walk west toward Oklahoma City. I walked down the middle of a residential street. A military jet made a shredding noise overhead. A Rottweiler in someone's yard strained murderously against its chain. Everything else was quiet. It was as if the population of Choctaw had been vacuumed out, as if they had scattered in another land run a few minutes before I arrived. Only the wind remained, stroking the trees. The weather was sunny and warm, with cotton puff clouds, completely unthreatening, exactly as it had been in 1889. The sky, the wind, they hadn't changed at all. What had changed were things on the ground. On the edge of Choctaw, I passed through a failed shopping center. An abandoned Blockbuster video was wrapped in yellow crime scene tape. A 99-cent superstore had handwritten closing sale signs taped to its dark windows. What looked like an abandoned construction site, a huge field of bright red dirt covered in concrete tubes, had a sign in the middle that said, Choctaw Town Square. I kept walking. One advantage I had over the 1889ers was that I was able to follow a straight and steady road. This was a gift from Stanley Draper. Highway 62, four lanes of traffic that extended, for no good reason, from El Paso to Niagara Falls via OKC. There were no sidewalks, so I walked through the dry, scrubby grass on the shoulder. Grasshoppers, big and small, hurled themselves away from my feet. Cars passed constantly, at roughly 50 miles per hour, a speed that seemed to belong to a different world. At one point, the driver of a white pickup truck stuck his head out the window and yowled at me, an incoherent animal scream, dopplering off toward the horizon in the direction of Buffalo. For the next 2 hours, that yowl was the only human contact I had. Otherwise, it was just me and the signs, speed limits, city limits, and advertisements for stores that looked like they'd been empty for 30 years. Each sign was a little slab of frozen Oklahoman language. Papa's Pawn Shop. We Do Boat Seats. Trailer Trash Treats. Gourmet Shaved Ice. Don Sean Drilling. DP's Cut Rate Liquor. Stack 'em high, sell 'em low. I passed a yard sale that consisted entirely of animal cages, ranging from the size of a deer to the size of a squirrel. Failed businesses lined the highway like bad metaphors, their billboards speaking empty words to cars. A big red arrow pointed to a beaten yellow shack. Edie's Chicken, said the sign. Its front door was held shut by a cinder block and labeled with a handwritten note. Thief, beware. Traps have been set. Enter at your own risk. I kept walking. I passed a dirt field that seemed to have been set aside for dumping dirt on. I passed prefab houses lined up like canned goods. I passed multiple automated ice booths. I passed an old yellow race car, gutted, with solid grass growing up in place of its engine block. Every once in a while, the landscape offered a scrap of pure beauty. A little creek ran off undisturbed into the woods, swooped over by iridescent birds. There were huge grassy sweeps that seemed untouched. I walked over dry Oklahoma dirt, Martian red and cracked, sculpted with occasional ant mounds. 4 miles in, a blister started forming on my left heel, and I could feel the skin on my face getting tight and hot and tender in the sun. Summoning the spirit of 89, I marched on. I started tallying the roadside garbage, hubcaps, empty rounds of chewing tobacco, soda cans crushed and bleached beyond recognition, a child's old bedroom door covered with Mickey Mouse stickers, a discarded work glove, a blank CD on which someone had written, in cursive letters, Melissa. I saw something that looked like a grenade, but was actually a drink called Buzz Balls. At a 24-hour gas station, probably around where William McClure had changed horses for the first time, I bought 2 Clif Bars and a toxic-flavored orange sports drink containing protein, which I had seen on the NBA's post-game media tables. This, I felt, was what the Pioneers might have bought. A killdeer sprinted across a field, faking a broken wing, trying to lure me away from its nest. I'm not sure what I had expected to find on my walk, but it was something slightly less shitty than this. All cities are rimmed by some form of non-city, wilderness, emptiness, suburbs. But this was uncommonly bleak. The outskirts of OKC had not been buoyed through the global economic meltdown by fracking money or public taxes. Beige vinyl siding reigned supreme. It made me think about OKC's obsessive quest for its entire history to turn itself into a real city, to build as majestic a downtown as possible and annex all of this inhuman prairie scrub and fill it with homes. OKC was more than just a city. It was an existential crusade, an attempt to assert the primacy of consciousness, of human life, in this endless sea of nothing. It had to keep booming, because whenever it stopped to rest, the prairie rose up and tried to swallow it. The promise of 1889 had turned out to be, for almost everyone involved, a fantasy. The route of the land run was filled with failure, ancient, recent, present, and imminent. Oklahoma's various busts had run on through the decades, mutating and growing, all the way to now. This countryside felt impossibly far from the downtown renaissance, the placemakers, the international glory of the thunder. After 4.5 miles, the land rose gently, and I thought I could see something in the distance, a vertical line bisecting the horizon, the tiniest hint of the Oklahoma City skyline. I couldn't tell if it was the Devon Tower or the Capitol Dome, business or civics, but it seemed like an outpost of civilization, so I kept walking. My sunburn was getting worse, and so was the blister on my heel, and as the landscape gently dipped and rose, that shadowy vertical line appeared and disappeared over and over, and I started to wonder, after a while, if it was a mirage. Maybe the pioneers had seen it, too. A mile or so later, just past Boss Hog Automotive, I recognized what I was looking at. It was the Devon Tower, far ahead and hazy, off to the left, but also, straight ahead of me, on 23rd, the dome of the Capitol. Business and civics, both of them. I kept walking, past wasted, wheelless cars sitting up on blocks, past a place called Anointed Hands Salon, where we're not just a salon, but a ministry experience. 2 hours into my land run walk, I reached a cluster of big box stores. My legs, at this point, were tired. I was breathing hard. The skin on my face was now officially burned. My blister was a problem. I bought sunscreen at Walgreens. On the counter was a stack of newspapers called Just Busted,